And it's great to read with Tom Devaney. I've known you for maybe 18 years, and I actually love that. I just think we're all so lucky to have friends that we get to see in different cities, and that they've watched us grow and we've watched them grow. I'm gonna be. Well, I'll just. I won't say it now, but I'll start reading from the Undergloom. Undergloom, and I will say that the title comes from the Iliad. It's the Fitzgerald translation. Can you hear me? Okay. Just says, and crowded brave souls into the undergloom. So, just loved that word, and it's only in the Fitzgerald translation. So I guess it's hell, Hades, or the undergloom. So this book is really, I think, a lot to do with institutions and race, and but I'm also trying to think about. I have a line from Stevens starting the book out, and it's Sailing After Lunch, I think. It's from the Stevens poem, Sailing After Lunch. I might be wrong. I can't, I'm trying to remember. And I have the line, it is the word pejorative that hurts. And this poem was for Eileen Miles, who was our Hugo Fellow several years ago. And then I see Peter Orner, who was our Kittredge Fellow, 2009, I think, yeah. So I, the other profiled in Cerulean for Eileen Miles. Could you look at me the way you look at him or her? Would this mimicry allow for some kind of simulacrum? It would comfort me. It would reassure me that I wasn't singled out. I could feel comfortable. I'm putting pressure on myself to write myself into the narrative. The word myself, what do I mean? If I don't understand, who will write me in? I'm only inside of reports and evaluations and things from which I stick out. I think about when I and other brown and black people get profiled in airports and in stores, on paper, professionals or educators portrayed as outsiders. It makes me ill just thinking about it, and when I write about it, I'm not sure I'm doing anything new or revolutionary except just thinking out loud on paper. We have enough flattering verse full of data. I'm not sure how I enforce datum in the poem, except to explore its material sense on the page, to place inside the poem the outside experiences, not the ones where I'm magnificent. Too many poets love their magnificence. Perhaps they claim words as objects for a kind of ownership of feeling. This is what frightens me. I do it too, but I don't feel like it's always authentic. Five questions, now statements. The overused idea of voice gives me no useful adjective for how to describe the moment of powerlessness, of how the mind speaks and cries. I am a sentence, but not much more. I am full of cunning and able functions, but not much more. I'm quantifying the smallness that I admonish, but somehow I then embrace it in the abstract as the theory of humility and hope it's concrete enough to be much more and not the tyranny of arrogance nor the troubling of the tiny. So I think one thing I learned about going into, I think a lot of us here teach poetry or studying poetry, or so you go into teaching in an institutional environment and you start trying to figure out how you're teaching craft and what does it mean and what, you know, what's the stuff you're teaching and what's the stuff you think you have to teach. So a lot of this book is about trying to figure out what, when you're artificial in your art and when you're trying to break out of that. Or you're talking about your social relations, which is, this one I'm actually trying to be funny, so you'll look at me with seriousness, but you can laugh. Grateful. Having the desire or reason to thank somebody. Your poetry about outsiderness, too outside the outlining norms, it made you look ungrateful. Erosion of integrated feelings, a breakdown of the soft side, like bad cheap bread. You could tell people thought they ordered a baguette, but they got you, bad cheap bread, dressed with bad dressings, trying to taste good. Of the towardness you yearn for as though it were inclusion, towardness replaced with something, not a collective revolutionary subjective empathy, no descriptive abject space to share with others the way you did in your urban environment, the way you used to follow and share abject feelings with others with a kind of careful and mindful allegiance, if this is even possible. And now you become the descriptive abject space and you're horrified. On top of that, you find that everyone claims to be a Marxist when really they're staunch constellations of teetering materialists. So when you are a glaring materialist with inner Marxist tendencies, you may appear tacky, but you are the outward of everyone's inward. It's all the same. There are attempts to stick you with the bill, to pat you with the so-so brush off. Or you think everyone is a modernist, flashing the collective rejection of individual heroes, or limiting the play between subject and object to offerings of a specific alien play, tending to the tiny, residual, personal fires or shocks to the system. However, you're no fool. You realized all this very young. What t-shirt must you wear to convince them of this? A recess for adults leads to more shameless bullying, an articulation of disclusion. The patent expires on your wares. You're interested in a new contemporary musical scene. Heyday. With meager spirit lodged heavy in the heart, I will notice now how it is suddenly turned abundant. I am fond of particularizing in certain ways, exploring this thinking in its sincere form, as if it were a particular heyday, an afterglow. For example, last night we all hit the table with clenched fists and free thinking, and the free thinking characterized in declarations of expression tied up with a red string of feeling. So right in purpose. One attaches oneself to a person who is an idea, who in turn squeezes your hand to share it. Don't discount lightness when it occurs. Life, with its usual bare, corrosive sense, keeps abuse thick and present. And so when we were all self-effacing in ways that felt spunky and kind, I became elated. I was pushing my identity, the real one. The one not struck with terror, the one not struck down by anyone. This is what I want every day, what I want for myself and for the future. Fumes of fallen rot go wayside for the hung, dissonant tree treasures. I shake hands with everyone I meet. I say, bring it on, I've had it all. Have you? And now I'm justifying my means. I'm not what you think. I'm inside a world of smallness, of fortitude and sorrow. It has all the trappings of symbolic engagements with society, yet there is no poetry in people. Moreover, I do love living for people in the way we must pass around the cup, in the way we push ourselves in, through the door with limbic certainty, with challenged eyes and wires pulling us up. This is for my husband who just passed. Sorry, it'll just take me a minute. just gonna have some water. Sorry, I haven't done that many readings, so we have trees now, more than we did before, but now we know what to do with them. We hang our troubles on them and wipe our shoes against them. We go lethargic on the porch. We tear the bark with spindly fingers. We soak up the sun with restless hunger. So much sky, we say in unison. Where does it go? Do we follow it? Do we let it get away? For months we splay without a fence, door wide open, blue and brash inside and out. Because we can, we keep saying, because we can. We face a lush sense of life that we have nothing to do with. We face our cravings and journey with a new kind, our new people. They all possess smiles and frowns, but more windswept expressions. No permanent downwardness of spirit the way it was back east. And since we've left the city to be ourselves, we still must face our needy souls, full of want, compulsions. Were we proud of this, the way we turned away? But we've protected these habits, foregone others in return. What is the profession of the cultural hoarder? Who are the gatekeepers? Do we grace them with our backs? Moreover, our chests remain empty, yet seductively warmed, burning by the fire, our asses cold and exposed. All the wood, crisp birch to shield our lazy lobes, rounded bodies, our cerebrums and other parts. Are we awaiting cheerless ambivalence to greet us in the west, cavernous and cloudless, unaffected by beauty? Let's be petulant. This is us now, we say. We can't help but find ourselves lustful, crying alligator tears with pails to our eyes. We didn't know we were here, we kept saying. We didn't know how it happened. We thought, and finally we closed our doors on the trees to hide what we grew temperate for, but resolve didn't find us, not alive with force. We flew out of their arms. I think I'll read some. I sound so dark, and I'm trying to kind of, you know, face abject the idea of being an outsider and just like going to sources of it or try to analyze spaces. So this one is kind of dark too. It's not in the book. A legacy. All this noisy commotion isolated a fairly small universe of nothing special. I'd faced the assistant to the incumbent, his failed face of poetry bottomless with self-pride and a satisfaction that fed his wolf. And he was a wolf. And when I scoffed at him with some penetration, I could see the clamor of his wounds, but also the vanity of his recognitions. He believed I was undeserving and thought his right to judge. And his judgment, a stun gun, took my gender and race and euthanized its center. And he thought this was an extension of the occult, that it was the intuition of a bright star affecting forward. I wanted him to see this in a particular light, but the particular worsened into a bruise of matter far more inhumane. And I fell into its hole, and he, with his glee, had no idea, because his gender and race gave him the privilege to look down and see my skeleton warped my will, but not the firmament of my broadness and what I know now as measuring across power and enduring many luminary deficits that come out of symptoms and their fallen edges. So what's really great about my English department is I get to teach, I have an MA in media studies, so I get to teach film classes. So I was teaching, they just let me do whatever I want to do. So I taught a class on Polanski and Cassavetes, and I realized that I wrote a poem about shadows, Cassavetti's shadows. But I was also reading book on Leslie Fiedler, and he taught in the English department in 55, and so this poem is called Love, Death, and Shadows, 1959 in Missoula. All errant glances looking off frame or directly at you, audience, in unresolved fury. I teach in our concave classroom with its ascending wooden hardback chairs and our flimsy broken shade with a stuck pull cord. Crimson light glares the room, so we squint to watch. I stand at a too large podium in a haunted building. I've been told some ghost stories, and I've been known to share radical ideas that were experienced as uncomfortable. Leslie Fiedler may have been in the same room, reconstructing the Eros and Thanatos, the interracial love he too foregrounded in essays, the anti-marriage, freeing the protagonists of classic American fiction from the adult entanglements of heterosexual passion, marriage, and domestic obligations. And he is writing in the 1950s, and Shadows shot in New York, where Fiedler's publisher lives. But Fiedler is here for some of the decade in his English department, understanding the racial conflicts and the homoeroticism before he writes No in Thunder. After Shadows, we talk about the racial hierarchy of the characters and the theme of passing. What about hypodescent? And here, what do we make of blood quantum, too? And we haven't gotten to the heteronormative white culture of the literary scene at the highbrow party. And Lila Goldoni feels she can be Lila, and we're not certain if she can or not. What kind of identification can she really have, or is it character immersion? Who among us in this classroom is African American? Nobody. We finish the conversation about improvisation, acting, and natural feelings. We agree how much we like Charles Mingus and Shifi Hadi. We talk about poetics and code switching, and there is an elated sense of connection I start to feel. I want them to know that the heap of film on Cassavetti's floor was the poem representing his unknowable reach, and he was going to have to take on its contradictions without knowing 21st century critical race theory and let his characters talk through their ideas, assertions, and pain. The interruptions on screen, characters' eyebrows, their compositional faces studied, their acting and finish of a film that in its early disappearance, its second version, screened with Pull My Daisy, still gave its transitions their moving edges and let Benny and Leela and Hugh, as Kaelin said in class, give us a cohesive family. Their tenderness anchors so much integration during segregation. And it was here with Fiedler coming back to his raft and leaving the buffaloes of Montana for Buffalo, New York, a place where poets found poetics in the future somehow. Why are the themes of miscegenation haunting us here or befuddling? We have poets too. Are we still resisting remote adorations and narrativity's formula for what couldn't be said about love and death in 1959 and what still can't be said now? Must it be through the improvisation that we find the substance and look at its ghost sightings and who wrote or shot film of whom and why? And why do I stand here feeling like it's all so hard to hold on to? And I'm just going to end with two poems for Dale. They're pretty short. I just started this, but one thing you'll laugh, okay? So I'm reading his notes on iPad, which you just shouldn't do for a couple of months. Just don't go through your husband's things obsessively. And I find that I find these notes about husbands, and they're like these weird confessions, adultery, vomiting, blah, blah, blah. And then I forget that he and I had taught Cassavetti's husbands in May last year. And so it was just funny. So this is from I don't know what this manuscript is going to be, but right now I'm just calling it Homelit Bereavement. My husband was a sound artist, and he had a moniker, Homelight Gravely, and he did a lot of great pieces. And then he was loved Philip Glass, and so this might be poems in contrary motion after Philip Glass. Complicated Spiritual Grief, Part 1. It was violent, and yet it wasn't. It was violent because it was the kind of cancer to which people referred to as beastly, to pure evil, and then to not really believe in a Christian God or the devil. I was left facing it. I'm a non-believer. When I faced it, all I had was this past before the cancer and what was leading up to it, which led me down his rabbit hole, which may have included a brain tumor and many other tumors, all the spindly parts, even things painted for me by his admirers, spindly grievers. I couldn't look at any of them. Because I am the kind of non-believer who believes in the culture around me, I was watching for fragments to arise out of our habits, like watching madmen or thinking about madmen, like Dale always said, like Cassavetes' husbands. I found his notes for teaching that film with me, and at first I thought it was a personal confession, but it wasn't. It was a list of notes. So what do I do now? I grieve. I lust for company that I can't ask for. I turn into my own madman. Can I do this? Did he enter my body, his energy? Can I be him lusting for himself? Thank you.